going on, the wars we fight, driving about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, believe it, let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country halls, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life,
yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, despite an amazing infusion of over 30 million Wall Street dollars, and even the endorsement of the President of the United States, unfortunately, and Donald Trump and Vice President Pence, Judge Roy Moore, the populist choice, prevailed tonight in the Republican primary in Alabama. This is a stunning reminder to President Trump that he is not the Trump Revolution. He has for a while led it, and in many ways led it very well. But the issues in the go far deeper than him. And why exactly he endorsed Mitch McConnell's tame choice for the Senate seat so ably held for over 20 years by now Attorney General, by the present Attorney General, is hard to know. It's really hard to fathom. However, the people spoke tonight, spoke loud and clear. Wall Street money did not prevail, and the endorsement of many of the key figures like Steve Bannon and most leading nationalist conservatives helped power Judge Roy Moore to victory. There will be a special election in December, the Democrat is fairly weak, and Alabama has been a Republican stronghold in the Senate for 30 years. So not likely to see a big upset there. But this is an incredibly important victory. And like it or not, it has given Donald Trump a very reliable man who will go into the United States Senate instead of basically a creature of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has proven himself ineffective in moving ahead Donald Trump's agenda, either ineffective or subversive. Take your pick. Well, this is, I think, incredibly important news, there's a excellent commentary on it, which I'm going to read to you. This is a commentary by a man who has been very, very perceptive on political issues. And this is Pastor Chuck Baldwin. If the foundation be destroyed, what can the righteous do? He says. By now, everyone should know that President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and the entire Washington establishment, including virtually every professional lobbyist, are doing everything, did everything they could to defeat conservative constitutionalist Judge Roy Moore for the United States Senate, Republican nomination for the United States Senate in Alabama. Rallied around the quintessential neocon rhino, that's Republican in name only, New World Order toady Luther Strange. This is Chuck Baldwin speaking. I've known Roy Moore since he was a circuit court judge in Etowah County, that's around Gadsden, Alabama. I saw the wooden Ten Commandments plaque in the Etowah County Courthouse that Roy personally carved himself before he took it with him to Montgomery when he was elected as the Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice. I was there with him at the behest of the American Civil Liberties Union. I was there with him when, at the behest of the American Civil Liberties Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center, a circuit court judge in Montgomery told him to remove the wooden plaque, which he refused to do. I was with him when, as the Alabama Chief Justice, a federal judge ordered him to remove a Ten Commandments monument that he had placed in the Capitol Rotunda, which he again refused to do. I was with him during the trial when Alabama Attorney General Bill Pryor prosecuted Judge Moore for refusing to remove the monument. I knew the Alabama Governor, Fob James, who had initially appointed Pryor as Attorney General. Fob told me personally that Pryor's commitment to support Judge Moore was a litmus test to receiving the appointment. It's an absolute fact that Fob James would never have appointed Pryor had Pryor not promised Fob that he would support Judge Moore's right to post the Ten Commandments. Pryor promised Fob that he would support Roy Moore all the way, in quotes. Pryor lied, but he didn't just lie. Pryor was the chief prosecutor against Roy Moore. Pryor is a lying, two-faced, double-crossing Judas Iscariot. I think you might have been expecting somebody even fiercer. And Bill Pryor got his 30 pieces of silver for betraying Governor James and Judge Moore in the form of an appointment to the federal bench by the wretched and evil George W. Bush. And many conservative Christians still believe that Bill Pryor and George W. Bush are good Christians. Barf, says Pastor Chuck Baldwin. Fob James had lion-like courage and was a staunch ally of Roy Moore. I stood behind Governor James when he held a press conference and told the nation that he would use the Alabama National Guard and state police if he had to do so in order to protect Judge Moore's Ten Commandments plaque should any federal police agency try to enforce an order from George H.W. Bush, federal judge, demanding that Judge Moore have it taken down. Governor James was defeated for re-election by a Democrat in 1998. The establishment Republicans had forced Fob into a primary election against one of their own toadies. Fob won the primary election, but the contest depleted his financial resources, and he lost the general election in 2002. George W. Bush
where chief political strategist Karl Rove was sent to Alabama to support a Republican lackey for governor who would roll over and leave Judge Moore to the mercy of the wolves. Rove succeeded. With a supporting governor out of the way, Rove helped orchestrate the prosecution, conviction, and removal from office of Judge Moore in 2003. Again, this was all done with the approbation, if not direction, of the good Christian George W. Bush. And guess who's back in Alabama today, trying to again defeat Judge Roy Moore? You guessed it, Karl Rove. The point is, the Washington establishment has been doing everything it can to destroy Judge Roy Moore from as far back as the George W. Bush administration and from federal judges appointed by Bush Sr. Yes, Judge Moore's biggest enemies have been establishment Republicans. Now Judge Moore is running for the United States Senate from the state of Alabama against the neocon, rhino, establishment, New World Order toady Luther Strange. And once again, the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Majority Leader of the United States, that's Senator Mitch McConnell, and virtually the entire Washington establishment are doing everything, or did do everything, they could to defeat this great American statesman. Judge Roy Moore is a graduate of West Point. He served as a company commander with Military Police Corps in Vietnam. He was so respected by the men he led that they nicknamed him Captain America. He was a cowboy for a while. He had a black belt in martial arts. He went to law school and got his law degree. He was elected circuit court judge and twice elected Alabama Supreme Court justice. He's a faithful husband, father, and grandfather. He's a Christian, in the truest sense of the word, not just at election time. He's a constitutionalist. He has a large portion of the Constitution memorized. He takes his oath to the Constitution seriously. He's a man's man. He is tough as nails. At the same time, he's a kind and gentle man. As kind and gentle man as one will ever find. And this is written by Pastor Chuck Baldwin. He said no to unlawful demands to remove his Ten Commandment plaques and monuments at least three times on consecutive constitutional principles. He knows how to lose everything for doing what is right. Judge Moore knows how to fight, and he's nobody's toady. Pastor Chuck Baldwin goes on to say, President Donald Trump is even remotely serious about draining the swamp in Washington, D.C., he would know that Roy Moore is exactly the kind of man he needs to be in the United States Senate. But it's obvious that Donald Trump didn't mean a word he said. I think there may be other explanations, but I thought was an extremely good backgrounder on Judge Moore, and very well written as always by Pastor Chuck Baldwin. Your Ward News is a feisty, paper in the East End of Toronto. They print over 375,000 copies per issue, it's probably read by about 1 million people. It's distributed not only in the East End of Toronto, but in bits and pieces around the world. Around Canada, and yes, a few in other parts of the world. It is a very good publication. Bills itself as Canada's foremost critic of Zio-Marxism. It is satirical. It's incredibly funny, and really manages to skewer the pomposity of the LGBTQ crowd, the radical Muslims, the Zionists, the lamestream media, and it goes after individuals right in the community. Well, I pass on all this by way of introducing a kind of sad little item that that occurred today, and that is the vandalism, and this is certainly not for the first time, of the Your Ward News offices. And they had their window broken so many times over the past 3 years that they in the end just boarded up the front. Then on the eve of a meeting where we were going to have the internet sensation of aliens speak, this was last autumn, both the front and back door locks were professionally sabotaged. I don't mean just a little bit of crazy glue or bubble gum. They were professionally sabotaged. They have since been replaced with locks that, and I won't reveal how, cannot be sabotaged. Well, sometime over the weekend, somebody spray painted KKK. Oh boy, is that ever funny. Oh, ha 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 ha. And hung a banner which says, "No storefront for fascists," with a hammer and sickle and A in a circle with a slash across it of anarchy. So I mean, it's interesting who it is who are the among the opponents of free speech, communists and anarchists. Well, Warren Kinsella, who is one of the prime opponents of Your War News, he and his wife have instrumental in whipping out a huge storm of protests and letters trying to get Your War News charged under the Section 319, this is the notorious hate law of the criminal code. A 3-year police investigation still hasn't concluded. The Kinsellas have personally filed criminal charges of, now let me see, what are the charges were for uttering threats against Your War News. The police were not, two police, separate police individuals refused to lay the charges, saying that the passages in question, or passage in question, is not a threat. Two Crown attorneys refused to lay the charges, but the charges were laid privately and will be, and the first, there have been two court appearances so far on that. Then this is a time waster. But anyway, Kinsella is a mortal enemy of free speech, has been for years. He was a major player with Jean Chrétien, when Jean Chrétien was a liberal MP, and he described himself as he was one of the backroom boys, had a big role in the campaign, and he describes himself as Chrétien's attack dog. And Kinsella is just a nasty piece of work. He has engaged in numerous Liberal Party internal campaigns, and in many cases appears to have worn out his welcome. In the race to succeed Jean Chrétien as Liberal leader, a number of prominent Liberals vied for that position, and one of them was Paul Martin, who was a bit of a leftist. But anyway, Kinsella was backing another candidate named Alan Rock, who's even more of a leftist. And Kinsella actually made accusations that Paul Martin's forces were racist because they objected to some of Rock's tactics of stacking nomination meetings with busloads of Sikhs. Well, the liberals may be many things, but it's hard to believe that the Martin forces were racist. In the last municipal election in Toronto, Warren Kinsella, who's nominally a Liberal, backed Olivia Chow, who's outspokenly, she's Hong Kongese, she's a leftist, and she's an NDP or Socialist Party, and she's the candidate of the left for mayor. He backed her, and he was part of her campaign.
Well, at one point, the mushy middle candidate, John Tory, who is no Tory, but anyway, John Tory, had an elaborate transportation proposal. And I won't go into it because it's really somewhat irrelevant. But anyway, Kinsella alleged because the proposed route of some rapid trans was not going to go through several heavily black areas. He put out the word that the Tory campaign were white supremacists or were supremacists. Well, that was too much even for his the candidate he was working for, Olivia Chow, and she quickly dropped him. The point being, Kinsella is a nasty piece of work. Well, what did Kinsella tweet today? With a picture of this banner, no storefront for fascists, with the hammer and sickle and the anarchist sign. Well, that's what he said. Neo-Nazis at your war news experience some peaceful community action. Good. Neo-Nazis. Well, editor James Sears, who is really the momentum behind your war news, he's an incredibly good satirical writer, has never claimed to be a neo-Nazi. And certainly Leroy St. Germain, who's a Métis, that is, they're a group of people who are mixed blood, Indian and white, has never claimed to be a national socialist. This is, of course, standard defamation. But I thought, you know, hanging a banner may or may not be an act of vandalism. However, the spray painting, cake, you know, Ku Klux Klan there, definitely is. It's a criminal offense. And it certainly shows you the mentality of people like of enemies of free speech like Warren Kinsella, you know, who basically approves of this type of vandalism, dressing it up as a peaceful community action. It's not peaceful community action. Warren Kinsella is utterly paranoid about people even having his email address. Can you imagine if somebody did that to Kinsella's garage door, assuming he has one? Well, he'd be off to the police so fast that he'd get a speeding ticket. Oh, the problem with the separatists in the province of Quebec is not they are separatists. I understand why they might want to be. I might not totally approve, but the separatist movement in the province of Quebec has been largely hijacked, as it has in Scotland, the Scots Nationalists, as it has in Catalonia, by anti-racist left-wingers. And they really are extreme left-wing social democrats. Not really nationalists at all. Well, anyway, here is a creature, I was going to say a woman, but is it a lesbian or transgendered? Lesbian, I think. Anyway, who was born in Nova Scotia, but anyway, identifies with the Quebecois. Nova Scotia born sovereigntist, eyes, Parti Quebecois, run. Jennifer Drouin, a native of Shelburne, Nova Scotia, who's lived on and off in Quebec since 2001, is attempting to secure the nomination in the downtown Montreal riding of Sainte-Marie-Saint-Jacques. After several years teaching English literature in the U.S., she's been a visiting scholar with McGill's Institute of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies, all the while doing a double major in law. Honest to God. They actually have a university department like that. Well, what's it called here? The Institute of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies. specializing in bullshit. Anyway, apparently she's another the closet lesbian. There's a picture of her in the Globe and Mail. And, you know, if you didn't have a caption, you would have thought it was a man. I don't mean manly looking. I mean, there is no female shape there. And she's got, I guess it's a she, has this sort of very short, spiky hair. There isn't the slightest trace of femininity. Well, I'm not surprised. It turns out, we're told here, the political novice said being a lesbian and playing an active role in the LGBTQ community made the riding, which comprises Montreal's gay village, the right choice for her. Anyway, she was blathering on about the quality she's going to bring to this farce, but if she wins the nomination and an out of the closet or in your face lesbian, you got a pretty good idea of the utter abandonment of traditionalist nationalist values that you would expect, but in the case of the Parti Québécois, you will not get. They are not traditionalists at all. And they would have entirely comfortable with having this strange creature running for them. Now, Professor launches petition to change Klan team name. Now that's Klan with a C. Okay, we're all literate boys and girls here. We know that C, the Klan with a C, C-L-A-N, refers back to. No, not the man in hoods. The clans of Scotland. The kind of extended family organizations, which are called clans. And if you're Scottish, you are probably very proud of the clan you come from. You know, the MacLeod, the Campbells, or whatever it might be. Anyway. From the university, this attack. A professor at Simon Fraser University has launched a petition to persuade the BC University to change the name of its sports team from Klan because it evokes a very different Klan, the Ku Klux Klan. you wonder if this professor can even read proper English. Well, anyway, this is Holly Anderson is her name. She's a philosophy professor. I think she's just addled. The teams have used the name to honor the Scottish heritage of the school's namesake for more than 50 years. Yeah, Simon Fraser was a very famous Canadian explorer who is probably the first white man in Canada, to what would become Canada, to reach the Pacific Coast, and he gave his name to the very important river that runs from the Rocky Mountains down through the Lower Mainland and through the city of Vancouver, the Fraser River, and that canyon is called the Fraser Valley. Anyway, and the university was named after him, and so the sports team is called the Klan, C-L-A-N, right? Okay. Philosophy professor Holly Anderson said Simon Fraser University is the only Canadian school to play in the National Collegiate Athletic Association, a league dominated by U.S. teams. Okay. And it's disrespectful to competitors, particularly black Americans, to force them to play against a team called the Klan, not with a C. Or is she saying that Americans, or particularly the black Americans or the Negroes, are so stupid, so illiterate, that they confuse C-L-A-N with K-L-A-N. If that is the case, and there's no evidence it is the case, but if that is the case, surely they ought to maybe drop out for a semester and learn a little bit about English spelling. She goes on to say, it's not that the term Klan is itself racist. The issue is the context. In Canada, the term is neutral, C-L-A-N. But in the U.S., it is as bad as a pretty bad swear word. Quite literally, it's a term that silences normal conversation. Why would it silence normal conversation? I don't see blacks in the United States as a particularly silent lot. In fact, maybe if they worked a little more and did a little less agitating, they might be more successful. Anyway, this is the level of nonsense that passes for politics today and passes for academe. Okay, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I've got to take a short musical interlude here, and I don't think we could do better than, well, we could if we could find it. I wanted to play, yes, Rebel Sun. I've been playing him a bit recently, and I hope you'll like him. This is a Rebel Sun, and this is Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee. Hard driving Southern patriotism.
I pulled up in the yard and saw a cotton field out back. He invited me to sit with him and share a fifth of Jack. He had crisscross bars and 13 stars blowing in the wind. He said, "Save your Confederate money, boy, cause the South will rise again." And Robert E. Lee did not like the Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. We talked about his troops and the rebel infantry, and those 13 southern states that live in infamy. As he took another swig of his black label whiskey, he said, "That Yankee pride don't mean a damn thing to me." He spoke about his men and how they always fought so brave, and how they wove their sacred flag, don't any life they gave. He struggled to gain independence for his southern ground. He stood up for his cause and never once did he back down. And Robert E. Lee did not like the Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Dream is still alive, even though his body's dead. memory lives on in the Southern soul. Along with his boys who fought and died out in the cold. Lee was a man with tons of courage, a hero without a doubt. He was a man with determination, he was a man from the South. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. He said, son, I've got many stories to tell. Ulysses S. Grant, kiss my ass and go to hell. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Drink him up, bro.
Sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee, and that's Rebel Sun. Gonna play another tune by Rebel Sun. This is Mr. Confederate Man. Great little story here.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants, and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big egg-shaped flag. She said, class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him? Well, the school bell rang and I thought, as the bus carried me across town. I got out my pencil and my notebook pad, and this is what I wrote down. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate Man. The next day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk. Then she called me up in front of everyone because she said she liked mine the best. As I walked up to the head of the class, my teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read,
Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate man. At home reading through the news, and just the other day, when I ran across my old teacher's name, and I saw she had passed away, with a bittersweet smile, I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath penciled words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Plus, Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate man. I wrote, Mr. Confederate man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate man.
That's a great song by Rebel Sun, Mr. Confederate Man. And
in honor of Joy, Judge Roy, this incredible victory tonight in Alabama. I'm going to play, I think, kind of a religious, nice religious song, nice gospel song. Jimmy Fortune recorded this, and this was a tune made famous in the mid-1970s by Johnny and June Carter Cash. This is Far Side Banks of Jordan.
I believe my steps are growing wearier each day. Still I've got a journey on my mind. The lures of this old world have ceased to make me want to stay. My one regret is leaving you behind. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. If it proves to be his will that I am first to cross, somehow I'll feel that it will be. When it comes your time to travel, likewise don't feel lost, for I will be the first one that you'll see. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. Sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. Through this life we've labored hard to earn our meager fare. It's brought us trembling hands and failing eyes. So I'll just rest here on this shore and turn my eyes away. Until you come, then we'll see paradise. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. Drawing pictures in the sand. And when I sunshine banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand.
Jimmy Fortune and Far Side Banks of Jordan. I'm going to read something from Breitbart now. Very apropos of what's happened tonight with Judge Roy Moore in Alabama. More good news, as my friend Jamie Kelso always likes to say. Conservative grassroots Alabama Senate candidate Judge Roy Moore faces off against D.C. establishment Senator Luther Strange, and all eyes will be on Alabama to see if Moore's grassroots muscle, endorsed by people like campaigned for by people like Steve Bannon, Sarah Palin, will defeat Strange's corporate money. And these are the figures I was looking for a little earlier. Judge Moore with 55% of the vote against Luther Strange, 45. That's a solid victory. And the D.C. establishment has poured at least $30 million into the race. That's a primary race of a real conservative against a phony conservative. And reportedly gave President Donald Trump plenty of happy talk to convince him to campaign for Strange. The swamp did so because they are reportedly terrified that if Moore wins tonight, other grassroots candidates will challenge in former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's words, swamp creatures in their own states. Just hours after the polls closed in Alabama, and this is the big news, Senator Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, who would have faced a grassroots challenger in a primary, announced that he will retire at the end of his term, essentially saying, no mas. Former White House strategist Steve Bannon campaigned for Moore in Alabama, and I gave a great talk, a speech for him at a rally last Friday night in Alabama, and on Monday said that a vote for Moore is a vote for an economic nationalist agenda that got Trump elected. Trump campaigned for Strange last Friday in the Yellowhammer state, but many voters who attended the rally indicated that though they still support Trump, they'll vote for Moore, who has led in every poll leading up to the win tonight. Excuse me. Trump, who never admits making a mistake, openly told the crowd that he may have done so by going against his grassroots supporters and endorsing a campaign for Strange on behalf of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, and all the establishment aligned groups that have shown nothing but utter disdain for grassroots conservatives and working class Trump supporters. And so when the votes came in tonight, a very, very solid victory for Judge Roy Moore. 55%, or roughly 262,204 votes against Judge Roy, Luther Strange's 218,000. And 66 votes, so 55% to 45%. hard to see that as anything other than a very solid win, and even better because it was a win for the grassroots against against the mega money of the Republican establishment. Alan Knutson writes, "Woohoo! The tide has shifted. I haven't felt this good since Putin announced he was putting troops and jets in Syria. What has happened? I knew that American power, largely Zionist power and intrigue, was checkmated in the Middle East." That's when Putin announced he was actually going to get seriously involved in Syria. "And that the world was on its way to recovery. Not without relapses, mind you, but definite recovery. likewise for the political climate here inside the United States. And this is a commentary by Alan Knutson. The election of Trump certainly was a telltale marker of a reversal of a downward trend line that he was and is walking a precarious political tightrope. He has no cultural command and control support mechanisms out there outside of the many millions of people who support him. And guess what? That was not enough. I think that changed tonight with the election of Roy Moore, Bannon's man against the Republican establishment man, Luther Strange, in Alabama. Even before the polls closed, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, as I've already mentioned, who actually questioned publicly Trump's competence, saw the writing on the wall and announced his retirement. His retirement at the end of his term for fear of a Bannon-backed populist conservative challenger against him who might just whoop his rear end. Corker knows it's over. Moore elected, Corker retiring. The tide has shifted. And all of Trump's tweets and talk about flag dishonoring at the NFL, that's what did it. He played them. He played them like a fiddle. It emotionally stoked what's left of the depleted American passion of what is right and wrong in America into an actualized support mechanism that expressed itself in a meaningful political way. No bullets flying or bloodletting, just an honest vote. This is excellent. Now, this is Alan Knutson writing. The tide has shifted. In a way, I suppose, I should be thankful to all those knuckleheaded football players who took a knee in opposition to Trump or whatever silly cause they claimed they were protesting. Some don't even know. The public's reaction against them boiled to the surface and then galvanized around Trump's American agenda. And in Alabama, at least, the election of Roy Moore. I think that's an excellent and insightful commentary. Here is an oldie but goldie. I first saw this when I was in teacher's college. That was a long time ago. That's 72, 73. And this is called a teacher's contract. And this was an actual contract back in 1872 here in the province of Ontario. Rules for teachers. Teachers each day will fill lamps, clean chimneys. You see, this is the time of the one-room schoolhouse in many areas. So teacher is also janitor. Each teacher will bring a bucket of water and a scuttle of coal for each day's session. They had to bring to help heat the place. Rule 3, make pens carefully. You may whittle nibs to the individual taste of the pupils. Those were, in those days, goose quill pens that had to be whittled or shaped. Men teachers may take one evening each week for courting, or two evenings a week if they go to church regularly. Notice, and this is a public school, the importance of being a Christian. Rule 5, after 10 hours in school, the teachers may spend the remaining time reading the Bible or other good books. 6, women teachers who marry or engage in unseemly conduct shall be dismissed. Yes, in those days, they didn't even want married female teachers. Every teacher should lay aside from each day's pay a goodly sum of his earnings for his benefit during his declining years so that he will not become a burden to society. In those days, there were no pensions. And so the teachers are reminded to be frugal and save. And they were not very well paid either. To be frugal and save so that they will have money aside so they won't be a burden on society when they decline or have to retire. 8, any teacher who smokes, uses liquor in any form, frequents pool or public halls, or gets shaved in a barbershop will give good reason to suspect his worth, intention, integrity, and honesty. Now, I think in many ways times have changed. In those days, Ontario had quite a Methodist streak. And these were people who were dead set against drinking. They were teetotalers. Now, these wouldn't be rules in every area, but this was at least in one area of Ontario. 9, the teacher who performs his labor faithfully and without fault for 5 years will be given an increase of 25 cents per week in his pay, provided the Board of Education approves. this is a thing many people find that almost quite, and in some ways it is. But this is the way we were, and what you know, you may draw many conclusions from this, but certainly one was the importance of religion and morals. A teacher was to be a moral leader, and so if he was if he drank or smoked or went to barber shops. Now, this is again a historical oddity that the barber shop would be to be shaved would be considered, I guess, somewhat loose behavior, a bit of a playboy. It would certainly not be the impression everywhere. But it's interesting how our pioneer forefathers, at least in some parts of the province of Ontario, really required a moral stature on the part of teachers, male and female. And if a female teacher were to get married, she would immediately be fired. At different time, I'm not saying every one of those requirements were necessarily the good old days, they were simply the old days that were. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.